I thought it was a great house, and at a price we could afford, despite being laid off after 10 years of steady employment and a new baby in my wife's arms. The area was rural. The nearest neighbors not even in sight from our kitchen window, and the previous owner had left a lot of furniture that we didn't have. From our small one-bedroom apartment in the city to this place, it was like finding a piece of heaven. The real estate agent had been nice, as she showed us several different places, all out of our price range. And then suddenly, the previous owner had passed, and his children didn't want the property, so it became available. I was eager to get the house. It was modest enough for our growing family. I mean, what else could we want? The agent had what I thought at the time a funny story to tell us. Before she could even tell us the asking price, she said that she was required by law to inform us that a paranormal research team had visited the house under the notion that the place was haunted. She assured us that the investigation happened 20 years ago and there was no evidence of any haunting, just some old family rumors that scared the residents at the time. We all had a laugh at that, especially my wife, Molly. We were both skeptics of the paranormal. We didn't believe in ghosts and vampires any more than we believed the moon landing was real. The agent didn't have exact details, but it was a clean house. I put a bid on it immediately, never bothering to inspect the house for damages or insect infestations, a decision I came to regret. Our first week went uneventful. Molly and I took the upstairs master bedroom, and little boy Ethan got the room next to ours. There was a third bedroom, which sparked Molly's interest in having another child. I didn't have a problem with that. The attempts were the best part for me, and she never knew I used a condom so that I could be with her without risking getting pregnant. She was so beautiful, with long brown hair and chocolate brown eyes. Her slight Asian heritage showed in the small slant of her eyes, and my purely European ancestry didn't mind at all. Her body was something I couldn't be more proud of. With her skin soft as satin and her ample breasts, there was no sign she'd ever been pregnant. The second Tuesday after we moved, then the problems began. There were subtle things, all which could be attributed to faults in the house, though I could see why someone obsessed with the paranormal would immediately assume ghosts were at work. Molly was the first hit as she went to take a shower before leaving for work. As she stood naked under the spray of water and the hot water stopped, she jumped out of the shower screaming. I comforted her with a large towel and then set myself checking the water heater. I thought it was odd that all the sinks still had hot water, but I was determined to check it out. I didn't have any experience, though. As a husband, I felt qualified. It was like I was given a book on how to be a man when I married. Just do all the things a husband was expected to do. I hadn't been in the basement much since moving in. The movers were the ones who brought all the boxes down, and Molly was the one to search through all of them. In my inspection, I noticed a strange architecture that formed the foundation to my new home. It was old, blended with cunning skill to the newer sections of the basement. I was never good with history and couldn't place it immediately, but some of the carvings reminded me of what Molly and I had seen in an old Roman church on our honeymoon to Ireland. That had been a special place. The tour guide had explained that the Romans had no known success past Hadrian's Wall in England, and the church was evidence that the empire had spread further than previously known. They even might have made it across the Atlantic, the guide had joked. A lot of educated historians and archaeologists were in the news infrequently talking about Europeans in New England long before Columbus arrived, though I barely paid any attention to it. The water heater was in the corner of the basement in what appeared to be the newer section, though the entire place was dark and filled with cobwebs of spiders long gone. The cylindrical device was in a recently built cabinet to hide it from view, as if the notion of finishing the basement had come to mind before being abandoned. There wasn't anything in the cabinet with the heater other than more webs that had been abandoned by their makers. I wondered how long it had been since anyone actually checked the machine. I had to brush several webs aside just to get a good look at it. I've already said that I'm not taken to believing in the unknown and mysterious, but I felt dread being in that place. I could feel eyes watching me, though I never knew the source. I swallowed my pride and looked at the heater, expecting to know nothing. But I did. A valve dial was turned almost entirely to the right. A worn label was beside it, but I risked the danger and turned it to the left, opening the valve. There were no explosions, and the heater didn't react differently, but when I checked the shower, the hot water was working again. I told Molly with feigned mastery, knowing that the valve was likely closed enough that it allowed some hot water through, but wasn't reliable. I fixed it, twisting one of the knobs until it was fully open. I stayed home, unemployed as I was. Molly appreciated it. I was able to watch our child and work on what I've always dreamt of, composing music. Ethan slept most of the time, waking only when hungry or after he'd soiled himself. It was good for me. The baby monitor I kept a few feet away was almost always silent, and because he couldn't tell me what he dreamed of, I didn't know what was going on in his head. Thinking of it made me laugh. I didn't know what a baby could dream of other than milk and maybe mom's breasts. I dreamt about them all the time. Other things happened, all that I was able to explain away. From the missing cordless phone to missing silverware, this could easily be my fault. Odd cold spots appear, but always seem to be the result of a broken vent or something else changing in the air around it. Then there were the lights. When I say that, I mean the lights would turn on and off, seemingly randomly, even if someone was in the room. I'd checked numerous times to see if there might be bad wiring, but I'm no electrician. We eventually bit the bullet, and after I admitted my ineptitude, called someone that really knew what they were doing. The electrician was a kid, barely out of school, who acted as though he'd had a lifetime's worth of knowledge. I led him to the basement and the circuit box, showing him the tangle of wires. He mumbled something about a long job and set to work examining the wires. I found a chair that was free of infestations and watched him work. When I was young, a contractor stole things from our house when nobody was around. Since then, I've always watched. I accept that people are flawed, but that doesn't mean I have to trust them. So as the kid started his work, I relaxed and pulled a worn book out of my pocket to read. I figured my presence there would be enough to deter any thoughts of theft. But not watching, I didn't see what was happening to him. I know that he was examining several wires that passed over the old part of the basement when I heard the noise. It sounded like a scraping sound, followed by a murmur of surprise and a whoosh of air. I stood to investigate, and the kid ran into me. "Burn it down, man. Just get out," he was saying as he collided with me. His skin was pale, his eyes wide. I jokingly asked if he'd seen a ghost. His silent reaction to that question was more frightening than his appearance. I left the discarded book on the basement floor where I dropped it after I'd ran into the kid. The electrician nearly broke the kitchen screen door as he ran outside to his truck. When I reached the door, the kid was already backing down the driveway. From what I could see, he was sweating profusely with the same shocked demeanor. In moments, he was gone. His tires screeched as he slammed the pedal down on his escape. Never seen that happen to a person. I didn't know what to make of it. Curiously, I returned to the basement to see if I could find what might have frightened the kid. I first noticed that the book I had left and thought fallen to the floor was resting peacefully on a small table beside the chair with a scrap of paper acting as a bookmark. I couldn't remember doing it. And considering that I dog-ear the pages when I take a break, the bookmark was highly unlike me. I put the small book back in my pocket and circled to the other side of the basement where the electrician had last been. It appeared as though he was at a portion of the basement where the old and new proportions were blended together with artistic grace. There was white dust everywhere, and I noticed that some of the wires were inside the wall, engulfed by plaster. I tugged one of the wires and made the same scraping sound I heard earlier. It wasn't hard to figure that the electrician was pulling out some of these wires when something happened to him. I looked at the several wires that were free and noticed that one of them had been pulled out, done by the electrician. I moved to inspect the area that the wire had been ripped from when I heard a sound that immediately took my focus. A baby crying. I rushed up the stairs to find Ethan lying in his crib, wrapped in his small blanket, crying. His eyes were pinched shut, and he was slightly curled in a fetus position. I went to him, thinking of nothing but my son. He cried as I picked him up, and as I held him close, he grabbed my sweatshirt with his small hands. I circled the room trying to calm him, but nothing worked. I decided to feed him and walked down the hall. Ethan stopped crying the very instant that I stepped out of the room. I looked at him strangely and stepped back into the room. Ethan began crying again, wailing as if haunted by something I couldn't see. I took him out of the room, and once again the tears stopped. I admit to my confusion as I brought him to the kitchen where Molly kept several bottles for him. I rested him comfortably in a playpen, and he could grow into using as I prepared some food for him. Once I knew it wasn't too hot or too cold, I went to my son. He drank some, but he wasn't as hungry as his crying would have otherwise suggested. He burped a little, and then fell asleep in my arms. I carried him to the master bedroom and put him in a bassinet in the corner. When Molly came home, he was still sleeping. "I'm home," she called as always. I went to the stairs to usher her up to the bedroom. I told her about Ethan's crying as she picked him up and carried him to his crib. He was sleeping and didn't wake when she brought him across the threshold. She found me, smiling as she always did, and led me to the kitchen where she prepared a small dinner for us. That night, we were both woken by Ethan's screaming, which reminded me again of his awful tears earlier that day. Molly brought him into our room, and he slept in the bassinet without disturbing us once. He slept in the bassinet for two more nights, stopping us from attempting another child before the sexual tension between us grew too strong. Molly waited for Ethan to sleep and brought him to his crib. At 2 o'clock in the morning, he started to cry. Molly once again told me that she'd handled the baby. Lying in bed, I could hear her pacing the hallway, whispering to Ethan. I couldn't hear what she said, but it was calm and relaxing, even to me. When she brought Ethan into our room, her inaudible words had put me to sleep. Three more nights, we attempted to sneak Ethan into his crib, and every night, he dragged Molly out of bed with his crying. By the third night, I could easily see the lack of sleep taking its toll on her. Her eyes were always red, and the skin under them was darkening. She even dressed in more muted colors, as if the rainbow of fabrics had no appeal to her. It was bad, and I resounded to solve the situation myself. The following day, I ran to Ethan's rescue, and after comforting him, laid him to rest in the bassinet. Then I went to Ethan's room to see if I could find anything. I checked the crib, initially thinking there was something wrong with it that upset my son, but it was fine. Then I checked the toys and even inspected the carpet, but nothing that would frighten a child. I was standing in the middle of the room, looking at the mirror on Ethan's closet door when I saw it. Someone else was in the room. I spun quickly, but the room was empty. I ran into the hall and quickly down the stairs, but found no evidence of another person in the place. I went back upstairs and inspected every nook and cranny in every room, but there was nobody. I went back to Ethan's room and looked around. After no initial signs, I looked back at the mirror. At first, there was nothing. And then I saw him. Almost my height, he was old, with a bald head, wearing a black suit with a black tie. He didn't look at me, but I could tell from the reflection that his eyes were glowing a soft red light like an old bulb. He turned to me, expressing no emotion, and then started to walk out of my vision. I turned to look and once again found the room empty. I turned to the crib where the man had stopped and looked. To my surprise, it wasn't empty. Lying there, half buried under Ethan's soft sheet, was that same small book I'd read in the basement. I couldn't figure out anything special about the book. It was just a story about a group of kids stuck on an island and how a misguided civilization grew. The place I stopped wasn't even special. It was still early in the book. Then I noticed the scrap of paper that had been used as a bookmark. It was a torn piece of newspaper that had been yellowed with age, advertising several small businesses in the area. One was circled in a dark substance that I recognized immediately. In my former job, I saw a lot of injuries, accidents resulting in bleeding or even hospital visits. I remember the color of blood so very well, I even imagined that it was a color necessary in a crayon box, but I also knew the color blood made when it dried on paper. It was a brownish color with just a hint of red. The longer it was there, the less red there would be. It was too clumsy to be a marker. Even the small grooves in the lines suggested that a finger was used to make it. It was for a psychic nearby, but I imagined that the paper was very old and the place closed. But with the way my son had been behaving, I had no choice but to try. I dialed the number and waited for it to ring. As I sat, I contemplated disconnecting, but a woman answered the phone before I could commit to such action. She sounded old, with a weak, wavering voice similar to the one my mother had.
"This is Researchers of Unknown Knowledge. May I help you?"
she asked. I looked at the paper and frowned. It wasn't even the right business. "I'm sorry," I apologized. "I have the wrong number."
"Were you looking for Madam Oracle?"
she asked. I wasn't expecting the question, but that was the name on the paper. Yeah, I was," I told her, almost afraid of what she'd say next. "I'm Madam Oracle, or I was when I was younger." She laughed and coughed for a moment. "My grandson works with me, and we started this a few years ago." "Oh, well, I hope you can help me. I started to speak when she cut me off."
"You found this phone number and you suspect your home may be haunted."
"How did you know?"
"Just a lucky guess."
Something told me that she had more to say.
"I also guess that you're skeptical about the paranormal. Well, I can assure you that we act in a very thorough, scientifically unbiased way. How's tomorrow afternoon?"
But I didn't say what was going on.
"No need, dear. It's better if we don't know. And I know your address. Caller ID."
She laughed and hung up. At the time, that was the strangest experience in my life, second to the mysterious man I keep seeing in my son's room. But I was determined to solve this. Anything for my little boy. Hell, I was already keeping him from having a sibling just so that he'd get the attention he deserved. I was the third of six boys. There was never enough attention to go around. We competed for the spotlight. I never wanted to put Ethan through that, and I didn't want him to suffer any torment. If the crazy bat I'd just spoken with could help, then so be it. I'd bend over backward for him, and truthfully, I hoped that he'd never remember any of this. I didn't tell Molly about what I'd done. It'd be better if, for both of us, if I alone had to live with the memories of this event. My only suggestion was to keep Ethan in the bassinet all night. Molly agreed with me on the count that she has less than 8 hours of sleep over the past 3 nights, and she was too tired to have to handle another of one of Ethan's mysterious nightmares. When Molly went to work the next day, I put Ethan in the bassinet and waited for the woman to come. The doorbell chimed 1 minute after 1 o'clock, and apprehensively, I opened the door. Her name was Bethany Warwick. She was near 80 years old and used a cane to support her hunched body. Her hair was as white as snow, and her thick black sunglasses hid her eyes from me. She was dressed in simple clothes, the same sort that my aging mother would wear, and bunny slippers. With her were two men. One was Theodore Warwick, Bethany's grandson, and the other was Francis Conway. Theo, as he introduced himself, was younger than me, in his late 20s, with cropped black hair and thin eyebrows over deep-set eyes. His eyes were small, darting back and forth like a nervous mouse watching for the stalking cat. He was wearing a polo shirt and khaki pants, carrying a large suitcase. Francis was shorter than Theo, but about the same age, with a brighter appearance that hinted at his bright attitude. He wore a shirt that read, "Who you gonna call?" on the front, and on the back was the Ghostbusters emblem. He was wearing jeans cut off at the knees and carried a suitcase like Theo's. They set their things on the kitchen table, one of the pieces that had come to the house thanks to the previous owners, and showed me their gadgets. They had something called an EMF detector, which could detect changes in electricity in the air, and a sensitive microphone recorder so they could ask questions and hopefully catch answers in the white noise. There were several cameras, all equipped with thermal scopes and motion detectors, as well as simple tools like screwdrivers and hammers. Not that he was proud of the simple flashlights, the tool she was most familiar with. I was given a camera to use and instructed on how to use it properly. Take 3 pictures in sequence from the same spot. Bethany took the lead and guided us to the baby's room without a hint of direction from me and stopped with her back to the mirror on the door. She had us line up opposite her so that we could see ourselves in the mirror in the room behind us. Gentlemen, have your devices ready. I'll call him. Don't be afraid if the cameras stop working. She must have been talking to us, and we did as asked. As she began chanting something in a low voice, the 3 of us watched the mirror. I had already seen the mysterious man. It was only a matter of time before they did too. We didn't need to wait long. The old man appeared behind us, rather than walked into view like the last time I'd seen him. Theo, who'd been holding the EMF detector, nearly shouted in surprise as the small gadget began getting high readings that weren't normal for a house, readings that were lethal to humans. Francis was asking questions, holding the microphone a foot away from his mouth. I would have taken a photograph, but the camera turned off in my hand and wouldn't turn back on. If the man's presence wasn't frightening enough, when he walked through me, I almost fainted. Now, he should have been visible, standing before me, but in the mirror we could see that he didn't appear whole. We could still see through him. He was saying something, which I hoped Francis was able to record, and then lunged at Bethany. The ghost grabbed Bethany by the neck and started to squeeze, choking her words. Theo jumped to the rescue, though it was hard to know what to do. Bethany looked like she was being strangled by an invisible hand, like Darth Vader in Star Wars. Only when Theo attempted to save her was she able to speak again. "Be gone. You're not welcome here." Her voice was raspy, but the ghost responded and released her, disappearing. As she started to fall, Theo caught his grandmother. Her eyes were closed as Theo lifted her off the ground and carried her into the living room. As we waited for the ambulance to arrive, Francis played back the recording so that we could listen. At first, it was just Bethany's rumbling, with questions from Francis breaking in. Then, there was a distinctly deeper voice that was clearer than any ghost recording the 2 men had ever heard. "I called Peter Foster. I was the priest. This land, the church, this room's where I lived. I pretended to be a Christian. Beneath my feet is the entrance to the real church, one you'll never see." That was the point the ghost attacked Bethany, and Theo shouted, forcing Francis to stop the recording. I looked at the 2 investigators, but they could make little of it. It was Bethany, who we thought unconscious, that broke the silence. "Secret door. Basement." That was all she could say, but that clicked in my head. Theo wanted to stay with his grandmother until the paramedics arrived, so Francis and I went into the basement to where the electrician had seen something that frightened him. I showed him the wires that were being pulled out, and Francis inspected the holes. He showed me that this section of wall was covering a small space. I didn't know what to do, but Francis did. He took a hammer and smashed holes in the wall until the sheetrock was weak enough to break. Took him almost 5 minutes to clear it away. What we'd thought was an alcove was actually the top of a set of stone stairs descending into the earth. Francis gave me a flashlight and we walked slowly into the darkness. I didn't know what to expect. But it was more horrifying than I could have ever imagined. Skeletons were suspended from the walls where once people were left to die, only their bones remained after untold years. Cobwebs and the small bones of critters filled the passage as we continued down to an octagonal room. There was a pit in the center with decaying matter that Francis identified as firewood and a floor-to-ceiling carving of a beast that I didn't recognize. It was over 12 feet tall and nearly the same wide, but it didn't represent anything that existed outside of the imagination. The thing had a cobra-like head that connected to a human body that its legs had fused to become a tail twice the length of the creature's head and body. It had 6 arms, thin like those of an insect, and a pair of wings that resembled those of a bat. There was an inscription, but neither Francis or I had any hope of understanding it. I found the camera dangling from my neck still worked, so I took pictures of it like I was instructed to do. And there was a crashing sound to my left, and I spun toward an opening to a dark cavern. Without thinking, I took 3 pictures and waited, taking 3 more before lowering the camera. I looked at Francis, who was frightened as I, when he suggested that we leave. I wasn't going to argue. When we got back to the living room, the paramedics were just pulling into the driveway. For her credit, Bethany seemed to be improving. She looked at me through the dark glasses and smiled.
I once came to the house and decided that it wasn't haunted. She coughed a little. Now I know that it isn't haunted. It's infested. So many souls are stuck here. This is no place to raise a child.
The paramedics took her away and Theo joined her in the ambulance. Francis followed in their van. Alone, I realized that they'd forgotten the camera I'd been carrying. With a deep breath, I turned on the camera and began scrolling through the pictures. The first were just those of the wall carving, though it did almost appear to move, but that could have been a trick of the mind. Then there were the 6 photos of that cavern. Seeing these pictures changed my whole outlook on life. I never doubt the existence of the paranormal again. The first photo seemed like a photo of a cave, with an odd-looking stalactite to the right. The second photo was of the same cave, but now a blur ran across the image and the stalactite was gone. In the third picture, the stalactite had moved to the left side of the picture. Nervous, but needing to know, I looked at the last 3. These were taken a few moments after the previous 3. The first picture showed the cave. No stalactites, and the walls appeared differently in the second image, something that was just beyond the camera's focus. All I knew was that it was big. The last photo nearly made me scream, and I've dropped the camera if it wasn't hanging from around my neck. Whatever had been in the second picture was closer. I could clearly see the cobra-like head and the dark eyes. The cavern was changing shape on account of the thing's large wingspan, then its arms and legs. Knowing how large the opening was, I can only imagine the magnitude of the thing. If Francis hadn't suggested that we depart, we would have been attacked by the alien creature. Miley came home and had to park on the street on an account of the numerous fire trucks and the police cars that had filled the driveway and front lawn. She found me carrying an awed Ethan as our home burned to the ground. The fires ate through everything, and they reacted strangely when consuming the basement, almost as though it was a large place deep in the ground. Our nearest neighbor, who happened to be the real estate agent, joined us to watch the house burn.
Such a shame. That house needed good memories.
She was shaking her head. Molly carried Ethan now and hardly listened, but I was curious.
What does that mean? Oh, I must have forgotten to tell you about the previous owner. It was a mistake, considering the circumstances around his death. The man who used to own the place was Mark's craftsman. He remodeled much of the place. Do you know it used to be a church until he changed things?
I should have told you that much. Some people are superstitious when it comes to living in an old church. Up until a few years ago, everything seemed to be all right for Mr. Craftsman. And then he started sleeping outside of the house. There was a camper in the driveway for the longest time. It was unused except for the bedroom and the small bathroom. Mr. Craftsman died while outside the house, just around the corner of the house where the door to the basement was. Must have been a heart attack. I heard nothing different. She spoke with a coldness I didn't expect. But when she turned to me, I saw pity in those eyes. I'm sorry I kept it from you. It's all right. I wanted to assure her of that. What about that haunting investigation?
That's a weird story without the paranormal part, she chuckled briefly. That psychic from town, I think her name's Madame Oracle, came. She was reportedly in the basement when something happened to her and her eyes were burned out from her skull. She wears these dark sunglasses now to hide the scar tissue.
She shivered. Molly looked at her but said nothing.
I think we're going to sell this place. We can't raise a child here.
Ever since history began, mankind has been fascinated by fire. In the days of the cavemen, the hunter's campfire was often the only thing that protected our prehistoric ancestors from the predators that prowled the dark. The scenario must have been terrifying, as the cavemen sat around their fire knowing that death watched from the shadows. Something about this experience must have imprinted itself upon the human race back in those days, for even today, a campfire can bring a chill to most people's spine, given the right circumstances. And one of the favorite pastimes on camping trips is to sit around a fire and tell scary stories. Many may find this tradition old-fashioned or cheesy, but I always felt a small thrill whenever the talk would turn to tales of the dark and disturbing while I was in the Boy Scouts. There is one night in particular that sticks in my memory, and when I tell people about it, they're surprised that I'm not in therapy. People sometimes ask me what's the scariest thing I've ever experienced. They're usually surprised when I tell them that I have to think about it for a little while. I may not look like the sort of person that strange things happen to, but I've had far more than my fair share of weirdness in my life. This is one such story. To begin with, I have to provide some background information. I'm the oldest son of a large family, and I live in the northeastern United States. I have to fudge the names of people in geographic locations, although some people may be able to recognize the places and people I'm referring to. One of the greatest joys of my high school life were my activities with the Boy Scouts. I am an Eagle Scout and a Brotherhood member of the Order of the Arrow, Scouting's Honor Society, so I'm no stranger to the outdoors. In fact, I so loved scouting that once I was old enough, I joined the staff of Six Hills Scout Camp as a summer camp counselor. Like most summer camp workers, I had co-workers who were among the most awesome people that I'd ever met, some who I wish I'd never met, and a whole lot of people in between. The two people that I hung out with the most were my friends Topher and Joe. I actually ended up going to the same college as Topher, and our camping experiences were how we became friends, but it's another story. Topher was a very logical guy who loved studying the plants and the animals of the wilderness and frequently expounded upon them at length, while Joe was more bookish and shy. The three of us were about the same age, and after our junior year of college, Joe found himself a girlfriend named Anne who frequently visited the camp. Unfortunately, for every Topher and Joe, there was Kyle. Kyle was one of those people who made my skin crawl, and yet for some reason, most women found him irresistible. He would frequently string along several lovesick girls at once, use them for what he wanted, drop them in a drift afterward, and then brag about it. Needless to say, no one could stand him, and the only reason he was on camp staff was because his uncle was the camp director. The last person on camp staff to play into this story is Bert. Bert ran the camp's health lodge and was primarily responsible for giving out medications to the campers that needed it. The fact that Bert was in charge of the health lodge was a source of great amusement to most of the campers, as he was very old and not in the best of shape. In fact, he often drove around camp in a golf cart, as he couldn't walk long distances very well. In spite of this, Bert was actually a pretty cool guy once you got to know him. He was an Eagle Scout, and had traveled around the world a good deal, although he was very reticent about why he traveled so much. If you got him talking, he could tell some fascinating stories about the things he'd done or the legends that he'd heard. As the last week of summer camp drew to a close that year, there was a sense of melancholy among the staff members. As much as the kids had driven us crazy, we would miss them. The last of the scout troops had left that morning, and Joe, Ann, Topher, and I were sitting around a campfire as the last of the evening light faded. As usual, the talk turned to scary stories, but we found that we had run through most of the classic ones already. The tales of the hook hand, don't turn on the light, and the licked hand had already been told, and we were running short of ideas. It was Ann who finally came up with a solution. "Hey," she said. "Why don't we tell each other the scariest true story that we know?" "Here we go with Baron and that Aztec idol again," said Topher. "Don't even joke about that," I replied. "That's a long story, which I'm not going to get into right now." "I'll go first," volunteered Anne. "Have you guys heard about those murders that happened up on the Mid-State Trail a few miles from here?" We agreed that we had. The campers had spoken of little else for the last couple of weeks. "Well," continued Anne,
You guys don't know the full story. The cops are treating it as a homicide because one of the guys was tied to a tree before he was killed. The strange thing is that the other man and the woman who were there were practically torn to pieces. They found parts of them a mile away from where they were killed. What type of man could do something like that? They also say some other hikers on the trail have been hearing strange things in the night. That's probably a coyote or a fox, suggested Joe. They make pretty weird noises sometimes. Not like this, they don't, said Anne. That's how I found out about all this stuff. My dad's a zoologist, and they brought him a recording of the sounds the hikers heard on the trail. He said it definitely wasn't an animal he'd ever heard. The strange thing is this. If some kind of animal killed these three people, how did that one guy end up tied to a tree before the bear, or whatever it was, disemboweled him? The thought was unsettling. We sat in an uncomfortable silence for several minutes, and we nearly had a heart attack when a twig snapped in the night. There was a short huffing sound, and then the antlers of a large deer poked over the top of a bush. We breathed a sigh of relief when we saw the antlers. The deer was just as scared of us as we were of it, and after a minute, we heard it move away through the bush. You know, said Topher, for some reason that reminds me of something that happened to me a little while ago. Topher turned to me. Do you remember that weird guy at the Order of the Arrow ordeal? Vaguely, I replied. I remember you talking about him, although I never actually saw him. That's right. You didn't actually see him because we were on different work crews. Anyhow, we were at our Order of the Arrow ordeal. Topher turned to Anne. It's kind of an initiation ceremony where we spent the weekend working. We weren't supposed to talk unless absolutely necessary. Anyway, to make a long story short, there was this strange guy who showed up at my work crew and just watched us. Since we couldn't talk, we couldn't ask him who he was or what he was doing there. He just stood in the trees by where we were working and looked at us. It was really creepy. I had to run back to the dining hall at one point to use the restroom, and he actually followed me for a little while until I ran into one of the scout mates. Probably should have told someone about the guy, but I thought I'd get in trouble for talking. That is a little creepy, admitted Joe. I probably wouldn't consider it to be the scariest thing that's ever happened to me, though. You didn't see the guy, said Topher. It's the way he looked at you. He looked at us the way the snake watches a rat before eating it. The reason I thought of this story just now was because of the noises that Anne mentioned. That night when we were walking back from the big campfire, I remember hearing some kind of weird animal. It sounded like a cross between a lion and a hyena. Is that what those hikers recorded on the trail? I'm not sure, replied Anne. That sound my dad heard really gave him the creeps. He wouldn't let me listen to it. At this point, there was another sound in the forest. This one was, unfortunately, all too familiar to the four of us. It was the unmistakable sound of Kyle's voice, followed by a feminine giggle from whoever was with him. A minute later, Kyle stepped into the firelight with a dark-haired girl who was clearly drunk, leaning against his shoulder.
Well, hello, everybody, exclaimed Kyle in a voice that was just a little bit too loud. I was fairly sure that he'd been drinking as well. Hope I'm not interrupting anything.
When he said this, Kyle made sure to leer at Joe and Anne. Anne narrowed her eyes and looked as if she was about to reply with a snappy retort until Joe placed his arm on her shoulder. After a second, she relaxed. Kyle had spent the last summer trying to seduce Anne to no avail. Then, at the end of the very last summer, Anne's little brother Tyler had died in an accident. He'd been 2 years younger than us and had worshipped the ground that Joe had walked on. He'd been at camp with us and had been one of the kindest souls I'd ever met. He'd gone out on a walk late one night and fallen down a ravine where he broke his neck to the point where it was almost decapitated. I still remember seeing the paramedics take out his body the next morning. The strangest thing about that situation is that the most vivid thing in my memory was the Captain America t-shirt Tyler had been wearing. Sure, it was all torn up, covered in blood, and an image still haunts my dreams. In the aftermath of the tragedy, it was rumored that Kyle had taken advantage of Anne's emotional state for his own purposes, although we'd never dared to ask her if this was true. Anne had only just started to recover a couple of months previously when she'd started dating Joe, and every
lecherous look that Kyle gave her was like a slap in the face.
"What are you all up to?" Kyle asked, pretending not to notice the death glares we were giving him.
"Oh, and by the way, this is Whitney," he said, gesturing to the girl hanging onto his shoulder. "She was hiking along the trail and got lost. I offered to put her up for the night until she can get her bearings. After all, there is a murderer on the loose." Wendy giggled again, and the rest of us tried not to visibly cringe.
"We were kind of telling each other's scary stories about things that have happened to us," Jeff said quietly. "I guess it's my turn now."
Kyle let out a harsh guffaw.
"Is that going to be about that poor baby Tyler again?"
he jeered. At this point, even I started to stand up to show Kyle exactly what I thought of him. Thankfully, for my well-being, Kyle was pale and scrawny, but surprisingly strong. Topher stopped me.
"He's not worth it," he said quietly.
"What's Kyle talking about?" asked Anne. "Something happened between you and Tyler?" Joe winced. It was clear that he'd not been planning on telling this particular story.
"It's kind of complicated," he began. "Thing is, I suffer from something called sleep paralysis. It's when you wake up from a dream and you're conscious, but you can't move. Sometimes you also see strange hallucinations. The most often hallucination for me are long-fingered shadows with way too many teeth. I would wake up at 3 in the morning and not be able to move. After a few minutes, I would hear something move under my bed, and the shadow creatures would appear. Sometimes they'd actually touch me. Even though I know they aren't real, I can still feel them brushing against my face or sitting on my chest. I had one of these episodes the night Tyler died. I woke up, but I couldn't move or talk. I saw Tyler sit up in bed. I saw him look at his phone and then go outside. He must have gotten a text or something. The point is that I saw a bunch of the shadow creatures follow him outside, and I know it doesn't make any sense. There's no way I could have warned him. I feel like I could have stopped his accident, and I couldn't." By this point in the story, there were tears streaming down both Joe and Anne's faces. Anne gently put her arm around her boyfriend's shoulder, and the two of them wept quietly. The silence lasted longer than a minute before Kyle interrupted again. "Well," he said, "that's all fine and well, but I have a real story to tell. It's the tale of what really happened to Ron Grayson."
Kyle paused dramatically to let the words sink in. Ron Grayson had been a local lawyer 10 years previously who had one day vanished off the face of the earth. They found his car abandoned in a supermarket parking lot and his cell phone in the river a few miles away, but there was never any body found. The incident was one of our area's biggest mysteries, and even 10 years later, just about everybody had a theory about what had happened to him. The prevailing theory was that he'd either killed himself or run afoul from some inner-city mob boss, but there was no conclusive proof either way.
"No one knows what happened to him," I said. "The man could have been abducted by aliens for all we know."
Kyle smirked. "That's what you think.
See, the thing is, remember 2 years ago when I had to spend a couple of days in jail on those drug charges?"
We remembered. The charges had been eventually dropped.
"My cellmate was this guy who worked for the mafia as a hired killer. He was there waiting trial."
We raised our eyes skeptically.
"I'm serious. This guy was a hardcore killer. He was a mess, though. Apparently there was this hit that went wrong a few years back. He and his partner were supposed to off this lawyer who was filing charges against his boss, so his boss sends my buddy and his partner to make the problem go away. Thing is, my buddy's old partner's like a cat. He likes to play with his food before he eats it. Anyhow, he convinces my buddy to kidnap this kid. They found some homeless kid up in Pittsburgh that no one would miss, and they bring him down here. They have this lawyer tied up in the woods, and they tell him they'll let him go as long as he shoots the kid. Sure enough, this lawyer guy shoots the kid to save his skin. Problem is that the lawyer's a horrible shot, so this kid doesn't die right away. He starts screaming bloody murder, and then something in the forest starts screaming back. My buddy got spooked,
So he gets in the car and leaves his friend to finish the job. Thing is, his friend never comes back. Buddy goes up to the place, they have the lawyer the next day, and there's nothing there. No lawyer, no kid, no psycho killer for hire, and no monster. Yeah, that's how the guy told me the story. Next day, he hangs himself in his cell. Get out, I look up, and he disappears as around the time this guy says this stuff happened, and I see that Ron Grayson disappeared around that time. So there you have it. The lawyer was eaten by a monster. He was the same one that killed those hikers. Once again, there was a sound in the bushes, and we all jumped. Off in the distance, we heard a faint howl. At the time, I figured that it was a coyote, but now, I'm not so sure. A second later, a light shone through the tree branches, and there was a strange rumbling sound. We all let out a breath of relief when Bert's golf cart came puttering around the bend in the trail. Huffing and puffing as if he had just run a marathon, Bert heaved himself out of the golf cart and sat down by the fire. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out a peppermint candy and tossed it to Kyle. Topher held out his hand for a candy as well, but Bert seemed to not see him. "Well, that's it," Bert sighed. "I just finished a run through a camp and everything's more or less in good shape, although Troop 83 did leave a giant archway in the middle of their campsite for some reason. Guess that means we should be able to get to the road pretty early tomorrow then," I said. "Looking forward to a few days rest before I head back to school for the next semester." "I think it's your turn to tell a scary story," Joe said to me. And so, I began my tale. "Kyle's story actually reminded me of something," I began. "I think I actually saw Ron Grayson at this very camp a year or so back." "He's dead," interrupted Kyle. "Didn't you hear my story?" "That must have been his ghost then," I continued. "It was really weird at any rate. I was doing a night patrol at the camp last summer, and I thought I saw someone down by the trading post. I just caught a glimpse of him as he walked around the corner. I thought it was weird, and I didn't recognize him as one of the scoutmates, so I decided to investigate it a little bit more. I walked up onto the trading post porch, and there was this man standing in the corner looking out over the lake. There were a few scouts on the other side of the lake, and the man was watching them. We stood there like that for a while, him watching the scouts and me watching him. Then he turned around suddenly and saw me. And then I swear, I'm not making this up, he grew a giant pair of antlers, screeched at me, and then took off into the forest. I thought about telling someone about it at the time, but I thought no one would believe me. The point is, I was reading the paper a few months ago, and I saw some news reports about Ron Grayson and that they had a picture of him. I realized that was the man, the one that I saw on the porch. At least before he grew a pair of antlers and did his best Nazgul imitation to my face. I actually have a picture of the article on my phone if you guys want to see it. I passed my phone around to the others in the group, and when it reached Topher, he went white as a ghost. "What's wrong?" I asked. "Nothing," he replied. When he saw that none of us believed him, he reluctantly continued. "It's just that that lawyer looks an awful lot like that guy who was following me around in my story."
My turn,
called Whitney, still very much intoxicated. "I was hiking the Mid-State Trail last year, just like I'm doing now, in fact, and one night I tried some new..." She cast a suspicious glance at Bert and then continued in a quieter tone of voice. "Stuff. I tried some new stuff. It gave me the biggest high of my life, but it also made me see some strange things. So anyhow, here I am in the middle of the woods and I have to take a crap. So I go by myself and take care of business. Keep in mind, during this entire thing, the trees are trying to tell me the meaning of life. I'm on my way back when I see Count Dracula fighting with Captain America on the top of this hill, and I realize that this is just the drugs, of course, but I still don't want them to see me. I can hear them yelling at each other. Captain was telling the Count to stay away from my sister or something like that. It was weird. Eventually, Count Dracula hits Captain America over the head with a stick and then throws him down the other side of the hill. At this point, I decided to get the hell out of there, so I slipped away. On my way back to the campsite, I see all kinds of crazy things. The trees trying to attack me. These little goblins would laugh at me from behind the rocks. I think I also remembered a bunch of bears and deer ballet dancing. It was a weird night. think I'm going to go to sleep now.
And with that, Whitney laid down and began to snore. None of us quite knew what to make of that story. Bert philosophically stared into the fire before tossing Kyle another peppermint candy. For some reason, Joe seemed particularly disturbed.
"She said she saw Captain America getting thrown down a hill by a vampire," he mused. The image of a blood-stained t-shirt sprang into my mind.
"You don't think that..."
"Oh, for crying out loud," yelled Kyle. He seemed to be very unnerved by the story as well, the look in his eye resembling that of a frightened rabbit who had just detected danger.
"You guys aren't taking that load of bullshit seriously, are you? She'd ingested enough drugs to kill Charlie Sheen. Nothing she saw had any basis in what was really going on."
"Are we sure of that?" murmured Bert. "There may have been a kernel of truth hidden in her story."
"Come on, Whitney, we're leaving," Kyle said roughly, shaking Whitney awake.
"Not now, Edward. I want to sleep," she replied, then promptly went back to snoring.
This response seemed to anger Kyle even more. Swearing at all of us, he stormed away from the fire into the night.
"Did he really kill my brother?"
said Anne quietly.
"We'll probably never know for sure," said Bert. "Whitney probably doesn't recognize what she saw consciously. No jury in the world would convict based on something that may have been a drug-induced hallucination."
"Oh, the fact that she called Kyle to Edward is telling. I saw Kyle and Tyler having a heated discussion the day before he died. I mentioned this fact to the police, but the coroner ruled the death an accident, and that was that."
"So he's just gonna get away with murder?" said Topher angrily. "Where's the justice in that?"
"Sometimes there is no justice in this life," replied Bert. "Sometimes we have to wait for the next life for our reward or punishment. In this case, however, I think the situation will take care of itself. It's getting late and I got a scary story to tell you all before we go to bed. It's about a creature that they once called the Wendigo." As Bert began this story, the fire seemed to die down and a cold wind sent a chill down our spines. Whitney let out a whimper in her sleep and curled up into a ball close to the coals of the fire. The shadows at the edges of the light seemed to stretch closer, and the instincts and nightbirds fell silent as they too were listening to the story. The natives would tell their children tales about the Wendigo. They sometimes called him a forest giant. Story goes that the Wendigo could change his shape so that no one could see him coming or kill him. Legend also goes that a man could become a Wendigo if he ever ate human flesh. That's how the old stories used to go. When I was a lot younger, I met a medicine man when I was doing some work on a reservation. He told me some more stories about these creatures. He said that a man didn't have to be a cannibal in order to be turned anymore. Although that was still a good way to become one if you ever wanted to do such a thing. He said that the creature was in constant pain as a result of the curse. As years went by, the pain would get worse and worse until it drove them into a frenzy where it killed anything in its path. Medicine man said that there was only one way for the Wendigo to stop the pain, and that was for it to attack someone who had been as wicked as it was, something with innocent blood on their hands, and turn them into the same thing. Then the pain would fade for a while, and eventually the original creature would die after it had created a new one. It was very difficult to kill a Wendigo, although there are certain things that attract them or repel them. They don't like light and the smell of garlic, for example, while fresh blood, peppermint, and the sound of young children will attract things like moths to a flame. A few years after the Second World War, there was a little boy who claims he saw one. Gone out on an overnight backpacking trip with his troop and became very sick. One of the scoutmasters had to drive him back to the dark along with one of the other scouts because of the buddy system. Now, the scoutmaster was a nice man. He'd only recently come to the United States and he claimed that he was Dutch. However, a lot of people were actually German, claimed to be Dutch, in order to come into the United States. We weren't that friendly towards Germans, seeing as we just fought a war against them. Rumors, scout troop was that this particular adult leader was one of those Germans who had pretended to be Dutch. Rumor went further that not only was this man a German, but he had been a Nazi.
At any rate, the leader and the two boys were driving along the back roads toward the hospital when all of a sudden they see this man standing in the center of the road. The adult leader swerves the car to avoid this guy and ends up crashing into a tree. One of the scouts was knocked unconscious in the crash, but the leader and the sixth scout were still all right. Leader gets out of the car, goes over to where the man is standing, and starts to yell at him. The man doesn't say anything, just stares at the leader and the two scouts. The sixth scout is back at the car and managed to drag his friend out of the wrecked vehicle where the scoutmaster had left him. At this point, the man in the road grows his big pair of antlers and opens his mouth wide. The scout can see that all the man's teeth are at least three times the size of a normal man's teeth and are very sharp. A strange man jumps on the scoutmaster and begins to tear him apart before coming after the boys. Luckily, the one scout managed to find a large hollow log and pulled his friend inside before the monster could get to him. Wendigo spent the rest of the night clawing at that log trying to get at the boys. Around dawn, it went back up to the road and crouched over the body of the scoutmaster. The boy then swore that he saw the dead leader stand up and follow the monster into the woods. The sun came up and search party found the two scouts a few hours later. The little boy spent the rest of his life looking up information on all kinds of monsters, traveling the world to hear the various stories about them so he could find out what had happened to him that night. There was a long silence after Bert finished the story. Finally, Whitney let out a drunken giggle. Apparently, she'd woken up partway through the story. "Stories were supposed to be true stories that actually happened to us," she said. "Sorry," Bert said after a slight pause. "My mistake." "Well, we should all probably turn in," said Joe. "We've got a long day tomorrow." "Sounds good to me," said Bert. Turned to Whitney. "Do you have somewhere to stay tonight?" "I have a campsite a few miles up the trail," she responded. "You know what?" said Bert. "You can sleep on the sofa in the health lodge. Something tells me tonight isn't a good night to be out in the woods alone." Bert helped Whitney into the golf cart, and the two drove off down the trail. In the distance, there was a very faint sound that could have been a human scream that was suddenly silenced. Shortly afterward, there was a strange call that sounded like a cross between a lion's roar and a hyena's laugh. Topher, Joe, Ann, and I decided to share a tent that night. I had a funny feeling we'd never see Kyle again, and we didn't. Topher claims that it is probably because he ran away for fear of getting arrested for murder. I'm not so certain. That night in the woods, I remember drifting off to sleep with dreams of antlered men and peppermint candies. Hey everyone, I hope you enjoyed tonight's stories. If you did, let me know which one was your favorite down in the comment section below. If you remember, in the last video I asked you if you've ever had an experience with a doppelganger, or if you believe they even exist. And I said that we would read one of my favorite comments from that previous video, and that's what we're going to do now. Thank you to Trish Pipkins for commenting. My sophomore year of high school, I moved to another state. At school, people kept calling me the wrong name, Lisa. And then one day, this girl was calling out, "Lisa! Lisa, wait up!" And I didn't pay attention. It's not my name. I got a tap on the shoulder, and I turned around. The girl said to me, "Lisa, why are you ignoring me?" I said, "I'm not Lisa." She said, "Stop messing around." I was with a friend who said to her, "This isn't Lisa, her name's Trish. You're confused." And the girl looked at me for a moment and said, "Oh, sorry." It was so weird. About 2 weeks later, I met Lisa. I guess we looked similar, but everyone else asked if we were related and if we were sisters. Lisa said to me, "I'm sorry. I don't see it, but even my best friend thought you were me. Do you think we look alike?" I told her, "Not really." So the girl who stopped me while I was walking was Lisa's best friend. She was so sure that I was Lisa. It was so weird. It was really odd to have so many people get us confused. Even teachers would think I was Lisa and vice versa. She was nice and wasn't evil, though. People said we were each other's doppelganger, but I didn't think we looked that similar. Trish, I'm glad you're safe. I'm glad it wasn't actually a doppelganger, and thank you so much for the comment. and sharing that interesting little tidbit with us. We're going to do the same thing for this video. Since the second story revolved around campfires and camping, what is the scariest experience you've ever had while camping? Or what is your favorite go-to campfire story tale? Let me know down in the comments section below, and I will read my favorite one in the end of the next video. Hope you all have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you again on Monday with a new upload. And as always, stay safe and stay out of the dark.